Okay, Parshat Vayera. First of all, good Erev Shabbos to everybody. Shabbat is coming. I am so ready for the Shabbos. A few years ago, first of all, I also want to welcome Dan and Alice Romano, who were our parents of an alum who came back to visit. You can never really leave Oraita, so it's really nice to have you this evening. Baruch Hashem. Any other visitors that I missed? No? Okay. So a number of years ago, my wife and I were in Tel Aviv and went to visit a place that I've always heard of and I'd never gone to before. And I found myself sitting in this little apartment, not really much to look at. And I'm sitting literally, it was a room. It's a little bigger than Rav David's classroom. And there's a big bed in there and a little chest or drawer kind of cupboard sort of thing. Little bathroom. And it's a museum. And you can't really fit more than six people at a time in this museum. And I was wondering what happens when a group goes there. But for whatever reason, there aren't that many groups that go there. And I really went because, you know, we were in Tel Aviv and we had like a couple of hours. And I thought it'd be interesting. Did not expect to experience what I experienced. There was something about that place. And I'm watching this little film that they have and reading some of the poetry and realizing that the person after whom this museum is named was an inspired person. And he wrote some beautiful poems. And he didn't have to be there. He was offered many different opportunities and avenues of escape. But there was something about this place that would not allow him to leave. His name was Avram. And he was one of those few individuals who lived what he believed. I cannot tell you that I always agree with his politics. In fact, some of his decisions I actually vehemently disagree with. But I have tremendous respect for any individual who A, lives what he believes, and B, has such a burning love for the Jewish people and for the land of Israel. And he was one of those few individuals who felt that there was no making peace with the British. You know, there was a famous line that was said, you know, I will treat the British as though there's no Holocaust, and I'll look at the Germans as though there's no British. And people who struggled with what to do, right? The British took over this part of the world in 1917. In fact, they just commemorated the Battle of Beersheba, which was a turning point in World War I, that eventually allowed the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, that paved the way for the British Mandate, that paved the way for them giving it back to the League of Nations, that paved the way for the decision of the United Nations, that paved the way for the birth of the State of Israel. But that doesn't mean that the British were big friends of the Jewish people. In fact, anything but. And there were different approaches as to how to deal with that. In 1939, when there were millions of Jews that were desperate to get out and had nowhere to go, the one obvious choice was to come here. This was our historic homeland. This was where we came from so many years ago. And there was lots of room. And the British could have just said, come. In fact, they didn't have to say anything. All they had to do was not stop anyone from coming. And they made it more and more difficult for Jews to come here, eventually passing the infamous white paper, which severely limited British Jewish immigration. It actually limited immigration, but everybody knew that was a euphemism for Jewish immigration. We were limited to 15,000 immigrants a year. That included the 7,000 or 8,000 that were being caught on the illegal immigrant ships that were already here that had made it out. Which means they were letting 7,000, 8,000 Jews a year in 1939, when you think about it. In the total period of the Holocaust, that's less than 10% of the Jewish community of Warsaw. That's before the rest of the Shoah. The Shoah could have been prevented. Had the British decided to allow the Jews in, there would have been no Holocaust. But the British were the enemies of the Nazis. And they were fighting, you know, you saw the movie Dunkirk, so now you know your history, right? Terrible movie. And it's an opinion. And so people didn't know what to do. How could you fight the British when they were fighting the Nazis? Avram Stern was one of those individuals who refused to compromise on his position regarding the British. And he fought them tooth and nail. He was famous. He was one of the key organizers of the famous Night of the Bridges. When the British passed the white paper severely limiting Jewish immigration, you may remember some of you saw a broken bridge when we went up to the Golan that still sits over the Yarmouk River. They blew up 14 bridges overnight, severely challenging British control of the borders. Some of those bridges have still not been repaired to this day. When the British captured two Jews who were caught with illegal weapons, illegal because they were holding them to defend themselves, and they flogged them, which is a public whipping, Avram Stern's group captured two British officers and flogged them in a public square, and so on and so forth. And the British began realizing that this was a leader who could not be put down, and they were afraid that this was spread. There was a very high price on his head, and they were turning over whole neighborhoods to try to find him. And he constantly had to switch where he was. Midnight raids, tips. Eventually ended up in this small apartment in Tel Aviv. And the widow who had agreed to put him up, they constructed a crawl space behind a bookshelf. And you could move the bookshelf aside, and there was a little crawl space behind a wall, right? And if the British were coming, he could sneak in there and close the cupboard from the inside, and he'd be safe. And this particular night, the British had a tip, and they burst into the house. They were searching all the houses in the apartment building, and they didn't find anything, which was usually the case. And they were about to leave. You know, it's always the little details. That's what gets you in the end. The British sergeant who was searching this room suddenly noticed a shaving brush. Now, a shaving brush in and of itself wouldn't have given him away because she was a widow. She could have said it was her husband's. But he noticed it was still wet because Avram Stern had shaved 5 minutes earlier. So they searched a little more diligently, and eventually they found Avram Stern. And they captured him. And it was later announced that he was killed while trying to escape. He was shot twice in the back while trying to jump out of a sixth-story window, except the British officer who captured him ordered everybody else out of the room before two shots rang out. And you can imagine what that story was really about. And he was killed. He was buried in the middle of the night because the British didn't want to make a martyr. And that was the end of Avram Stern, but not the end of Avram Stern, the Avram Stern gang. And you can go to this house, this apartment, and I urge you to do it. I think it's something worth seeing. And you can be in that place where he was, and you can try to take in that energy. And you kind of sit there and you wonder, why didn't he leave? He was offered a number of escape routes. They wanted to smuggle him out to get him to Switzerland. They offered him a chance to get to America. He couldn't leave. So he was killed. And for me, sitting there, it raised up that whole question of this place. What is the power of a place? You know, last week we spoke about that if you change a place, you impact yourself, you change your mazel. This week, there is a fascinating halacha that we learned from this week's parsha. It's the last place in the world that you would expect to learn this halacha, this Jewish law. Okay? It occurs in the middle of the story of Sodoma. Okay? Hashem comes to Avram and he says, I'm going to destroy the city of Sodoma. Which in and of itself is quite an incredible thing to do. Can somebody do me a favor? There's a cup with water in it on the back fire escape over there that I forgot to... Don't lose me. Just send it up here. It's a strange thing that Hashem does. Hashem comes to Avram and says, I'm going to destroy Sodom. That's the equivalent. Thank you so much. That's the equivalent of God coming to one of you and saying, I'm going to destroy Nazi Germany. I mean, that's the image. Thank you. That's the image. I'm so from. Right? That's the image that you have of Sodom. I mean, Sodom was the epitome, the paradigm of evil. They tortured their visitors. Right? They were cruelty par excellence. And whatever they represented, and you can read the Midrashim rabbinic legend on what they represented, at least ostensibly from the Torah's perspective, that society had reached a level of evil that it no longer merited to exist. So Hashem comes to Avram and says, I'm going to destroy them. It's an interesting question, why Hashem comes to Avram to tell him anything. Destroy them! Then begins one of the most bizarre conversations in the entire Torah. Do you remember the conversation? Hashem says, I'm going to destroy Sodom. What does Avram say? You can't do that. Shofet kol haaretz lo yashtem mishpat. The ruler of the world won't do justice. So what do you mean he won't do justice? He is doing justice. He's killing the wicked. Ah, but what if there are some righteous people there? So God says, you know what? If there are 50 righteous people there, I won't destroy the city. So Avram now, he says, wow. I asked for the city of Sodom. If there are 50 righteous people there, and God says he won't destroy it. Now at that moment, what should happen is that Avram should say, thank you. And that's it. But Avram says, what if there are 40? Now the fact that Avram asks that question should tell you that Avram himself has doubts whether there are 50 righteous people in Sodom. So God says, you know what? If there are 40, if there are 40 people, no problem. We'll save the city of Sodom. And then Avram's still feeling lucky. He's like, what about 30? I mean, this is a ridiculous conversation. You know? Well, we'll go with 30. What about 20? 20. Well, hello, 7. Right? Like, what about 10? And God says, you know what? 10. We'll go with 10. What should be the next part of this conversation? What about 4? What about 3? That's a Zimun. What about 3? But there Avram stops. It's a very strange conversation. Like, you're arguing with God. How many righteous people are there in Sodom? Anybody know?
One.
Possibly one. That's an interesting question when there's one. Prove to me that there isn't one.
We see Lot's not as righteous as we thought he was.
Well, if Lot was righteous, then Lot would have been saved because he was righteous. But that's not why it says Lot was right, saved. Where does it say? Vayizkor. And God remembers Avraham. And the rabbis talk about what that means. He remembers that Avraham saved Lot from being, when he was captured. So Lot is saved because of Avraham. If Lot was so righteous, he would have been saved because of Lot. Who do we know who was saved because he was righteous when everybody else was destroyed? Noach. And Torah tells us, Noach ish tzaddik, he was a tzaddik. If Lot was a tzaddik, he would have been saved too. So there's nobody righteous in Sodom. One could make a suggestion. And Avram seems to know that. So what's this whole argument? Like, well, let me ask you a question. Hashem decided to destroy Sodom, right? Did Sodom get destroyed? Yeah, along with 4 other cities, right? Sodom gets destroyed. Does God know Sodom is going to get destroyed?
Yes.
Yeah. So was Sodom always going to be destroyed?
Yes.
Obviously. So what's the game? Okay. So they have this debate, and then that's it. You know, now we break for our news advertisement. And then God comes along, and he says, okay, you know, the malachim come, the angels come, they get Lot out, whatever happens, happens. And now it's time. Justice is about to be served. Right? Right? This is Perek Yotet Pasuk of Gimel, 1923. Right? God rains fire and brimstone, and you know, it's a disaster. And Sodom is being destroyed. And what does it say? And Lot doesn't look back, and his wife looks. It's all strange story. And right in the middle of all this, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. And Avraham arises early. And he goes back to the place where he stood before God. That's a strange thing to do. And he looks out on the valley. And on the whole plain. And he sees what's going on. So what's that about? What, Avram doesn't want to miss the Sodom show? Good fireworks? Doesn't anybody want to come? This is a strange story. So the Gemara takes note of this, right? By the way, as you learn more Torah, you become sensitive to terminology. Vayashkem Avraham Baboker, and Avram arises early. What does that obviously remind you of? The Akedah, right? The Binding of Isaac. That whole story after Hashem says, Kach nad bincha techil, take your son, your only son, blah, blah, blah. So the next morning, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. Avram arises early. Now, if you were being told to go take your son and slaughter your son, would you get up early? I wouldn't get up early. I'd sleep late. I'd have a good breakfast. You know, give him a last supper or something. What does it mean that he rises early? So does anybody remember what the commentators say, what Rashi says? Anybody remember? Pardon? I can't hear you. I wouldn't say he's excited. Like, he doesn't wake up in the morning, gonna slaughter my son, it's gonna be a lot of fun. Like, he doesn't do that, right? But why does he arise early? Because if this is what Hashem wants of me, then for this moment I've been created. Avram understands this is a mitzvah, it's a mission. And you don't crawl to do a mission. You run to do a mission. Right? Somebody asks you to do a mitzvah, you don't say, okay, do it or don't do it. So Vayashkem is a language of fulfilling my mission, my meaning, my purpose. He jumps out of bed because it's a chance to do what Hashem wants him to do. So why is that here? He's just getting up to watch the show. There must be something deeper going on. So the Gemara in Brachos takes note of this. And the Gemara says, isn't it interesting? He goes back to the same place. Why does he go back to the same place? What famous halacha on Daf Vav Amid Bet, on the sixth folio of Brachot, are we going to learn from this pasuk? Anybody know? Pardon? Nope. Anybody? Really interesting halacha. Listen to this. Gemara says like this. Okay? Amar Rabbi Chelba, Amar Rav Huna. That's exactly right. Good one. Picked it up. We learned from this halacha that there's a mitzvah, there's a halacha, there's an obligation to attempt to daven in a set place. Now, this doesn't mean you walk into shul and kick the orphan out of your chair because you have a makom gavua. It has its parameters. I actually daven in the shul where part of the, what do they call it? The preamble? I don't know. They got some word for it. The takanon. I don't know what they call it in English. But the official rules of the shul is that no one has a makom gavua. If you want to sit in your place, you got to get there in time. Right? You know, when I grew up, I was in a shul where if you came after 9:30, my shul's not allowed to get it. If shul's at 8:15 and you show up at 8:16, someone's in your chair, then he's got the chair, right? Which is, I think, a beautiful halacha. You know, you don't embarrass somebody for a seat. Nonetheless, there's a mitzvah to sit in the same place. So you should get up and get there on time so you can sit in your place, right? So where do we learn this? So Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rabbi Chelbo, Amar Rav Huna. Rabbi Chelbo says the name of Rav Huna. Kol ha-koveh makom letfilato, whoever sets a place for his davening, Elohe Avram be'ezro, then the God of Avram will help him. In other words, good will come into your life, and you'll have a little, God will have your back, but not just God, the God of Avraham. The merit of Avram will be for you. Ukeshemet, and when such a person who has a makom gavua, such a person who has a set place where he davens, where he prays, when he dies, obim lo e'anav, whoa, look at this great humble person. Ei chassid, what a righteous person. Mitalmidav shel Avram Avinu. He is of the students of Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu minalam to cover makam. How do I know that Avram Avinu had a set place? Dichtiv v'eshkem Avram b'boker, ela makom asher amad sham. Because it says Avram arose early and he went to the place where he stood. Listen to this. Ve'ein amida el atfila. Whenever the Torah says that a person is standing, that's a lashon of tefillah. And it quotes a pasuk, Vaya'amod Pinchas Vayifalel. And Pinchas stands and he palels. Now we've studied tefillah together, and we've learned Yaakov Avinu was on his deathbed, and he says, Ra'u fanecha lo pilalti, I never paleled, I would ever see your face again. Talking to Yosef when he's on his deathbed because he thought Yosef was dead. And Yaakov says, "Lo milani bibi lachshov ki arecha shuv." I didn't imagine I would ever see you again. And Rav Kook therefore says, "Lehit palel," the reflexive, to struggle with what I want, with what I wish. Tefillah is all about struggling with what I want. When Pinchas is standing, if you remember the story of Pinchas, and Pinchas sees a prince of the tribe of Shimon cohabitating at the entrance to the tabernacle, to the Mishkan, with a Midianite princess, it doesn't get worse than that. That's not like sneaking out of Shear to like have a piece of cheese after you just ate a meat lunch. That's getting a cheeseburger and sitting on a Torah scroll in the ark and having a good bite. Right? I mean, that's unbelievable. So Pinchas stands up, Vayifalel. What does that mean, Vayifalel? He's struggling. What do I do? Nobody's doing anything. And he has that moment. He's asking himself, what do I want to do? And why do I want to do this? And do I think Hashem wants me to do this? And if he's got the answers to those questions, he turns Zimri and Cusby into shish kebab. So the Gemara says, before he vayefalels, it says he stands. Why does he stand? Standing is a language of tefillah. To stand up, to figure out what you stand for. Why is this halacha? This this law, this rule of Makom Kavua, why is this learned in the midst of the story of the destruction of Sdom? What does this have to do with Sdom? What does making sure you sit in the same place for Mincha have to do with the destruction of Eva? I like peanut butter. Do you ski? Well, what does one have to do with the other? They make no sense. Right? And furthermore, what is a Makom Kavua? What does it even mean? What's the difference where you pray? The big difference should be who you are when you pray and what you're doing in prayer. What does it mean to have a place? And of course, that question is a much bigger question, because it's not just a question about whether you sit in your place when you come to daven, when you come to pray. It's a larger question about space and place. What's the difference where my place is? You know, I have a friend who, let's just say he's not a deeply religious thinker, but he's a very deep thinker. And he thinks the big problem today is sacred space. He says people are too tapped into sacred space. Everybody's arguing over space. What's the difference? He says, take all the Jews, go to Switzerland, give up the Temple Mount. What's the difference? Is it worth one drop of blood for any space or place? Can a place be worth a human being? So let everybody get on planes and go to Wisconsin. Right? And he said to me, you know, and I remember once I had a long discussion with him. I said, first of all, do you think if all the Jews went to Wisconsin, anti-Semitism would stop? For 2,000 years, we weren't in this place. It doesn't seem that that's what anti-Semitism is about. But I said, that's not the issue. Right? Should we give up this place? That's an interesting question. What is the power of place? What is the power of space? What does it mean to have a Makom Kavua? Why do we need a Makom Kavua? Right? So, it's interesting, the Torah Tamima, right, this is Baruch HaLevi Epstein, who quotes this Gemara, and he makes an interesting point, right? He says, it's this one, but this one quotes this one. On the Pasuk in Bereishit, he tells you that he has a comment that you should look at in Sefer Shemot. So you look up in Shemot. What does he have to say there? So he quotes a Pasuk. The Pasuk says, Bechol Makom, this is in Shemot Perek Chaf. It's the prelude, really, sort of the continuation of the Ten Commandments at the end of Yidro. And it's talking about the mitzvah, the last mitzvah after the Ten Commandments, after Parshat Yidro, at the end of the Parsha, is to build a Mizbeach. They were meant to build an altar, a space where we can give back to Hashem, right? Okay, and the altar, the Mizbeach, is the foundation of Tzilah. So what does it say there? It says, Mizbeach Adamat HaSelecha, V'zavachta L'Avodolotecha. You should build an altar, and you should offer up your offerings. Bechol HaMakom Asher Azkir Et Shmi Avoy Lecha Uverachim. And in all the place where I will sort of mention my name, or my name will be mentioned, I will come to you, and I will bless you. Okay, I will increase my presence amongst you. Something good will happen. So the Torah Tamima quotes the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi in Brachos, Perek Dalet Halacha Dalet, says like this: Asher Tazkir Lo Ne'emar, Ela Asher Azkir. Mikan Shetzirich Adam Litmakel B'Makom Shu Miyuchad L'Tfilah. A person has to daven in a place that's set aside, that's special, that's uniquely set aside for tefillah. If you want to know, you know, I don't know, you woke up late, and, you know, you're in your college dorm, and it's 10:30 in the morning, and you want to daven. Does it make a difference if you daven in your room, or you go to the Beis Medrash where you normally daven, hopefully? So actually, you should really go to a Beis Medrash and daven there. Now, I can understand if you go to the Beis Medrash, you go to the study hall because there's a minyan, or because everybody's davening. But it's 10:30 in the morning. What's the difference if you daven there or you daven here? So we would see, the Yerushalmi says, that a person is supposed to pray specifically in a place that is set aside for tefillah. Right? And the Torah Tamima explains, what are we talking about here? The Beit HaKnesset. You're supposed to daven in the Shul. Now, what is a Beit HaKnesset? What does Knesset mean? Do you ever think about that? What does the word kinus mean? Anybody know? To gather together. A Beit HaKnesset is a place where people gather together, where all the wantings and the wishes and the dreamings and the struggles are brought together to one space and one place, right? And he says, "V'tzarach lomad the samech ad rasha de bavli." The Yerushalmi is basing itself on the Gemara we quoted before from the Talmud Bavli, from Brachos Daf Vav, that a person is supposed to have a set place. So now that's an interesting question, right? Umevua, so you might think maybe a makom kavua is not your seat. Maybe a makom kavua set place is the shul, that you should daven in that shul. So the Torah Tmima goes on, and this is already debatable. Umevua od b'Yerushalmi, it's clear in the Yerushalmi Kan, degamba b'Knesset gufei tzarich liyached makom. That even if you're davening in your shul, you still have to set aside a specific space. So I want to understand this. And one more question. There is a fascinating Mishnah, right? Which is also a Mishnah in Brachos. And the Mishnah says like this. This is in Perek Dalet, Mishnah Dalet, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Ha'oset tefilato keva. If a person makes his tefillah keva, ein tefillato tachanunim, then his tefillah is not tachanunim. Now what does that mean? Right? So, the portion here, right, the commentary is quoting the Gemara actually, right, the Bar Tanura, Ravadi Bar Tanura was a early Achron in Italy, I believe, late Mishon, early Achron, I don't remember, 1600s I think, but I could be getting it wrong. Somebody should look it up. Shetfilato domeh alav kemasui. To make your tefillah keva is to make your tefillah seem like a weight. V'lashon keva sheomer chok kavu alai litfalel. There's a rule, I'm obligated to daven. I'm doing it because I'm supposed to. V'tzarich ani latzeit mimena, I just can't wait to get out of it. Sound familiar? Right? Okay? Someone who does that is missing the point of tefillah. And the Tiferet Yisrael here says, what does it mean to make it like a masa? Retzano lomar shechotfa. He just grabs a tefillah. Do you know what it looks like to grab a tefillah? Right? Grab a tefillah is like, Asher Shevedech, right? That's what it sounds like to grab a tefillah. You gotta do it, so you do it. Let's get it done with. A person who has that kind of tefillah, it's keva, it's just a rote. Ein tefillato tachanunim. So unfortunately you explained, there's no chen in his tefillah, right? There's no beauty. There's something missing. So that Mishnah implies that you should that you shouldn't make your tefillah keva. So how come on the one hand I have to have a kavua, a set place, but the tefillah itself can't be kavua? Which is it? What is the nature of a makom kavua? What is a set place, and what does a set place have to do with stuff? So I want to tell you that there are two ideas here that are almost in tension with each other. And they're worth thinking about. The first is the impact that space and place has on us. We underestimate the power of place. And I would go so far as to say that there are two aspects to place and space. One is the physical space that you're in, and the other is what happens in that physical space. The people that you're with, right? And we don't consider this enough. I remember when I used to do reserve duty, one of the most challenging parts, especially in my first 10 years in reserve duty, I was in a unit, a tank unit, and there were people in this unit from all over the country, every background you can imagine, and there weren't that many people with kippot on their heads. And, you know, there are a lot of pros to doing reserve duties, but there are definitely certain cons. And one of them is that you have a whole genre of the population that views the reserves as kind of a chance to get a break. You know, take a break. Clear your head. You're not at work. You know, you're out. Whatever it is, you're on Jeep, you're in patrol, you're with your army buddies, you could let your hair down. And sometimes what that meant is that all the mores that held true when you were at home, they didn't apply here, right? So you were married back in Tel Aviv, but now you're in the army. So like whatever you do in the army stays in the army, right? And maybe, you know, you were a lawyer or a banker and you had a certain etiquette of speech, but when you're in the army, what's the difference? And on the one hand, you know, when I was an officer, I wanted to be connected to my men and you want to be with them and you want to laugh with them, whatever. And on the other hand, I realized, you know, it impacts you. I remember the first Miluim I did, the first reserve duty I did, I was like 25 years old. I hadn't been out of the army 6 months, and the first intifada broke out, and they needed officers, and one thing led to another, and they asked me if I'd volunteer, even though you don't have to go the first year, and I went, and we were in Gaza. We were in Jabalia, which is a nasty little piece of real estate, middle of the Gaza Strip, and it was a very difficult miluim, and, you know, people getting injured, and rocks, and Molotov cocktails, and shootings, and riots, and whatever. Totally unprepared for this. And at the end of the Miluim, they make like a big party, you know, because everybody finished. Well, maybe it was my second Miluim, I don't remember. And everybody got safe. And that's a reason to celebrate. It's the last night of Miluim. And the new unit has come, and you're doing Chafifa with them, and so it's a little looser. You don't have as many men on. And whoever is not on patrol comes, and they set up a big thing. And because they had gotten to know me, and I was one of the officers, right, even David Adler, right, because they got to know me, so they made an effort. Now you're taped. They made an effort, right, and they asked me where they could get kosher food and what kind of kosher food I would eat, and I was really only one of a few guys at the kibbutz. That blew my mind. They were going to make this whole party with kosher food. So I thought, that's amazing. So they bought kosher meat, and they asked me how they could kosher the barbecue, and really it was like, I was like, this is unbelievable. And then at one point, you know, because I had gotten in the habit, I was making kiddush for them on Shabbat, and I would kind of throw in divrei Torah here and there whenever I could. So they said, you know, Bini, agid lanu mashu, agid mashu, say something from the heart, you know, chazak, from the power, right? And I get up there, and I'm talking, and I start to say a divrei Torah, and I'm like, this is amazing, right? Jewish army, whatever. And everybody's like, great. And, you know, they had a couple of bottles of vodka, and it was all a very happy evening. Whenever guns, vodka, it goes well together. And then they sit down. And I'd never been in one of these before. It was my first reserve duty. And then a van pulls up. Right? And all the guys start turning their chairs around, and I'm like, what's going on? And the van pulls up, and they put up a generator, and they set up the generator, and they open up the doors of the van, the back of the van. And they pull out this big movie screen. Right? Movie screens. You may remember what a movie screen looks like. And they start showing a movie. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. You can watch a movie. Like, in the middle of nowhere, they just pulled up and they start watching a movie. It took me about 60 seconds to realize this was not Bugs Bunny. It was a celebration of biology. And I couldn't believe it. Like, I just finished giving it to Vartora. And I was like, whoa! So I got up, and I obviously had to leave, whatever, and the guys thought it was funny, whatever. They all started laughing, whatever. And I realized, like, I'm not in Kansas anymore. You can't be in an environment like that and not be affected. I used to come back from Miluim sometimes, as much as we all talk about the beauty and the power and the things and the men, but you still, you feel like you need to go to a mikvah from the things you hear and the things you see. How do you choose your space and your place? You know? The place that you sit in is the place that carries your energy. And I'll tell you something interesting specific to the Beit Midrash you're sitting in. Each of you is sitting in a makom where someone sat last year. And the energy he left there was not the beginning of the year, it was the end of the year. You know? There were masechtas that were finished in the places you're sitting in. There were students who came here so removed and so far away from learning who fell in love with Torah in the place you're sitting in. There are 10 years worth of students that have been sitting in this place. The collective energy of exploration and journey and meaning and discovery. Like, you dance tonight before Marav and you hear one nigun. But I hear, like, you know, 400 of them. Because it's like every night. And every Thursday night for 10 years. And there's a power to this place. And you'll see, you know, when you're back wherever and you're sitting in your living room and you want to open up a Gemara, it's going to be much harder. Right? So on the one hand, there's a power to being in a space. There's a power to being in a place where other people share that energy. And there is no place on earth that brings the power of place to bear like the land of Israel. And I could describe this till I'm blue in the face, or you could just close your eyes and go back to the valley of tears and remember sitting in that valley and get the power of place. You know, you can think back to Elul. Maybe you went down to the Kotel one night when 100,000 Jews came to hear Slichot. There's a power to this place. So on the one hand, Avram gets up. Why does Avram get up in the middle of stone? So here's my theory. Hashem comes to Avram and says, I'm going to destroy stone. Avram's not arguing. Avram's question is not whether Hashem is going to destroy stone. If Hashem is going to destroy stone, stone is going to be destroyed. And if Hashem is not going to be destroyed, then it's not going to be destroyed. That's not Avram's question. Avram's question is, what am I meant to do with the imminent destruction of stone? What does Hashem want of me? You read an article that there's a kid and he's sitting in an orphanage home. And for whatever reason, Hashem puts that in your face. You're expecting to have a parsha shir, and somebody gets up and, you know, came over to me a little while ago and said, you know, I was supposed to speak today. I can't. Can I speak today? Gets up, speaks for 5-10 minutes on this incredible project of orphanages. And so Hashem basically came to you and said, I'm going to destroy stuff. I'm going to destroy Sodom. I'm going to take this orphan. I'm going to destroy his life. I'm going to turn his mother into a prostitute. I don't know. We don't understand it. And the question is not what's going to happen to that boy, because that's up to Hashem. The question is, so what do I do with that? What does Hashem want of me? And I think what Avram understands is that in order to be an Avram, do you ever wonder why Avram becomes the first Jew and not Noach? It's actually not so complicated. It's something we wouldn't have the audacity to say, but Chazal say it, the rabbis say it. Because Noach gets into the ark alone. He doesn't bring anyone with him. Hashem says, I'm going to destroy the world, build an ark. And he says, okay, how big do I build the ark? There's no argument. He's a tzaddik, but he's a tzaddik on his own. Avram refuses to accept the destruction of Sodom. That's what made Avram Avram. And Avram arises the next morning. Because if you're an Avram, and Hashem is destroying Sodom, even Sodom, can you stay asleep? If you knew, if anybody here ever read, you know, my uncle was a captain in the British Army. And he refused. He refused to buy anything Japanese. He refused to eat anything Japanese. I remember once they got together and they had sushi. He got up and walked away from the table. He said, for him, that would be like bringing a piece of gefilte fish with a Nazi swastika on it. And I remember once, like, I didn't understand what's a big deal with Japan. And he told me some of the stories of what they did to British soldiers, the march in Bataan. I mean, horrible things. And if you read the book or saw the movie, what's it called? Defiant, Unbroken. You got a little taste of it, right? And that was Sodom, right? So if you knew that the next morning they were going to bomb Hiroshima, and you understood that would lead to the end of World War II and the destruction of an evil empire, and that millions of people would be freed, and hundreds of thousands of people would be saved, could you just go to sleep? Because if you could just go to sleep, then there's something wrong. We should be restless at night when we read about what's going on in Rwanda and Sudan. We're not. That's a problem. So Avram rises up and he goes back to the place because he wants his relationship with Sodom to be in the same space and the same place where he argues with Hashem. We should refuse to accept evil in the world. We should refuse to accept suffering in the world. And if we can refuse to accept that, then we can leave it up to Hashem to decide what to do with it. That's one side of the equation. Other side of the equation. And by the way, it's interesting. Avraham goes back to the place. That's actually the opposite of another famous biblical figure. Remember the story of Bilam? Bilam tries to curse the Jewish people. And he goes up on a mountain and it doesn't work. What does he do? Changes his place, goes to another place. That's the antithesis of what Avram does. Avram goes back to the same place. Now, if you keep changing your place, it's because it's not really about you. It's the place. If I'm not into learning, or I'm struggling, or I'm not doing chesed, so then I switch my place. I go sit in another place. Or I go to another Beis Midrash, because it's the place. It's much harder to say it's not about the place. It's about me. When I'm in the same space, and the space doesn't change, then I'm able to sort of ascertain much more whether I'm changing. And that tension, that challenge, is the secret of a Makom Kavua. So Hashem should bless us. You know? That we should value the spaces that we're in. That we should choose wisely and carefully the places and spaces that we put ourselves into. That we should be able to see little by little how the places that we're in impact us in positive ways. That we should be wise enough to recognize if we're in spaces that are impacting us in negative ways, that we need to move from those places, and we'll get to that in Hilchot Deot. And that we should most of all appreciate what a gift it is to be in this place and in this space at this time. And everybody should have an awesome Shabbat.